From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Are charter schools the answer to education reform? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Charter schools are being touted as the free market alternative for parents whose kids are stuck in failing institutions, especially in inner cities. In the aftermath of Katrina, New Orleans has embraced so many charter schools, it's become ground zero for the entire movement. On To the Point, we'll ask New Orleans superintendent and others what works and what doesn't. Are entrenched bureaucracies being overcome? Are teachers' unions coming around? Most important, are charters upgrading student achievement? On Reporter's Notebook later on, North Korea makes good on a promise. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney back with To the Point. The charter school movement is growing fast all over the country, but in New Orleans, charters encompass no less than 53% of all public school students. On To the Point, we'll talk to educators and others in New Orleans. And elsewhere around the country as well. Are charters the answer to education reform? We'll hear about teachers' unions, student achievement, and the impact on traditional public schools. On Reporter's Notebook, the U.S. and North Korea are engaged in diplomatic steps which could lead to the blowing up of a nuclear cooling tower on an international TV. We'll hear more about that process. First, this news. For the first time in history, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the Second Amendment protects the right of an individual American to own a gun. The court split 5-4, with Justice Antonin Scalia writing for the majority. Michael Doyle covers the court for the McClatchy newspapers. And, Michael, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So the majority said that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to have a firearm. But Justice Scalia also said this: it is not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner whatsoever and for whatever purpose. What's the significance of that?
Well, the Justice Scalia was signaling very clearly that this ruling today does not mean the end of all firearm prohibitions. He specifically cited the longstanding bans on the possession of firearms by ex-felons or by the mentally ill, or bans on carrying firearms in the schools and government buildings. So the court's majority is saying that while there is an individual right to bear arms, state, local, and federal governments do retain some capacity to regulate it. The next test now will be to see how far those regulations may go.
So that would suggest then that there will be challenges to various gun control laws around the country.
There will be lawsuits and plenty of them. I think that the next step for the plaintiffs in this case, the gun ownership advocates and others who challenge the D.C. ban, will be to target other what they view as extreme gun regulations and bring those to court as well. The American Bar Association warned in a friend of the court filing that there will be perhaps endless litigation now and challenges to see the scope of this constitutionally protected right.
You mentioned the ban in Washington, D.C. That's what this case was about. That's what the court threw out. How strong was that?
Well, it was pretty much absolute, and that's really what did it in. It was essentially a ban on handgun ownership by anybody except a former or retired District of Columbia police officer. It also required owners of firearms, rifles, to keep them with a trigger lock or disassembled. And several points in the opinion, Justice Scalia and the majority stressed the absolute nature of that prohibition as reason for it to be challenged under the Constitution. So we can assume that the more narrowly tailored a gun regulation is, the more likely it is to survive legal challenge.
What did the dissenters have to say? Once again, split decision, 5-4.
Well, it was 5-4, and it was fairly much the typical or traditional 5-4 split on this court. And some on the dissenters maintained that there might be an individual right to bear arms, but they didn't really address that so much as the fact that they considered it a reasonable step for the district to take, given public safety requirements, to regulate guns in the way that they did. I should say the opinion is well worth reading by by listeners. You can go to it at the Supreme Court's website. Both Justice Scalia for the majority and Justice Stevens in the dissent go into incredible detail on the history of the Second Amendment and the language and the precedents, and you can get a very good historical understanding of their dispute.
Talking with Michael Doyle with the McClatchy Newspapers. Interesting that, of course, the Second Amendment mentions service in the militia. The argument has often been between that and individual ownership. Did the court mention the militia?
Oh, they went into considerable detail into the definition of the militia, and the question has been for decades whether the reference in the Second Amendment to the well-regulated militia meant that the purpose for gun ownership was in the service of a militia to protect the state. Justice Scalia, for the majority, concluded that that is not the limitation upon the amendment. But if you want a excruciatingly detailed history of militias and where they've come from, then again, you'd want to read this opinion.
John McCain says it's a landmark victory for Second Amendment freedom. Barack Obama says that the court has given us much-needed guidance to local jurisdictions across the country. Is this going to be an issue in the presidential campaign?
Well, Senator Obama had a fairly nuanced opinion or reaction, which could be interpreted as hoping that this will not become a major issue in the campaign. He disagreed with the striking down of the D.C. gun ban, but he says that he agrees with the notion that the Second Amendment protects the right of individuals to bear arms. And so Senator Obama viewed through a political lens, has taken a nuanced position that for gun owners, he's telling them that he supports the individual right, but for public safety advocates and others, he says he thinks that the D.C. gun ban was a reasonable restriction. So where Senator McCain was four square in support of the court's opinion, Senator Obama was straddling perhaps a little bit.
Well, Michael Doyle, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for your time.
Reporter in the Washington Bureau of the McClatchy Newspapers. In a moment, are charter schools the answer to education reform? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. With 53% of its public school students enrolled in charter schools, New Orleans has become ground zero for the latest national movement in education reform. It's the logical place for this week's conference of the National Alliance for Public School Charters. In a moment, we'll talk with the superintendent of what's called the Recovery School District, created in the aftermath of Katrina. First, here is education columnist and reporter for The Washington Post, Jay Matthews. And Jay, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hi, Warren.
We need to begin here, I think, with a definition. What is a charter school?
Charter schools are, first to remember, public schools. They use tax money like all public schools, and anybody who wants to send their kid to a charter school can. If the charter school gets full up, then it selects students by lottery to make sure it's completely fair. But they are independent of school district rules. So many charter schools appoint principals who have the power to hire and fire their teachers, which very few regular public schools have. They also have the power to try different kinds of curricula, different rules. And the best ones are very focused on results. They're very firm on raising achievement.
How important is the concept of choice?
Well, I think parents love the idea of having a choice between a regular or a charter school. The problem with charters is that, on average, there are only about 4,000 in the country. That's about 4% of all schools are charter schools. And if you look at their test scores, their results, on average, are about the same as regular schools. But the best charter schools are way better than the best regular public schools because charter schools unleash the energy of our best teachers, people who really know how to teach, know how to motivate kids. In the inner city, the best schools we're seeing, the ones who have raised the achievement of low-income kids the most, are charter schools.
Jay Matthews, Washington Post education columnist and reporter. But let's go to New Orleans, once again regarded as ground zero in the charter school movement. Sean Gallagher is executive director of the Akili Academy Charter School in New Orleans. That's a K-8 public charter school. And Sean Gallagher, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
How'd you get there?
Interesting. I've been a part of two charter schools in Philadelphia, and the opportunity to be a part of what's happening in New Orleans was just something I couldn't pass up. We have an opportunity post-Katrina to work in a system of schools rather than a school system, with a large bureaucracy not present after Katrina. The opportunity was here for people to come down and open up charter schools.
So you left Philadelphia and, unlike a lot of other people, moved to New Orleans.
Yes.
In order to get this opportunity. How's it working out?
So far, it's fantastic. Again, Jay spoke to this a little bit, the opportunity to have so much freedom in how you plan a school, and particularly for me, how you operate with your budget. We have the freedom to, for instance, we've made the choice to spend the bulk of our money on teacher salaries to attract the very best teachers to the school. And I'm not tied to a district pay scale when I do that. So the freedom is just fantastic.
How does that work? How can you set the standards and still meet whatever limitations are put on you by the fact that you're using public money?
Well, I look at it as I would say we're probably the essence of what I think a public school should be, in that we have the freedom to do what we need to do or what we think we need to do to close the achievement gap for kids. And we're held to very exacting standards. We sign a contract with the state of Louisiana delineating exactly what we'll deliver on. And if we don't deliver on that, we'll be closed in 3 years.
So well, how do you have to deliver then? What standards can you tell us about that you will be held to?
The one that gets the most press and the one that is, you know, probably the most relevant is test score data for students. We need to be able to prove that our students are operating at or above grade level. And specifically to meet the mission of our school, we need to be able to prove that we have kids on track to graduate eighth grade and have choices when they apply to high schools, to be able to get into the very best high schools in New Orleans, whether those are public or private.
Do you feel that you are under a microscope because New Orleans has attracted so much attention with the public schools, with the charter schools?
I think we are, but I think it's a great thing. This is an opportunity to, as I said, to have a city school system look different. And there is a lot of pressure, but it's good pressure. I mean, we need to step up and prove that this kind of a system is something that could work in Philadelphia or Cincinnati.
Again, Sean Gallagher is executive director of the Akili Academy Charter School in New Orleans. Once more, a K-8 public charter school. We'll come back to him and Jay Matthews, of course, later in the program. But first, here's Paul Vallis. He is superintendent of the Recovery School District in New Orleans, again called the Recovery School District because so many of the schools in New Orleans were destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. Superintendent Vallis, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Was this a kind of silver lining for New Orleans, the destruction of the schools and the opportunity to set up what Sean Gallagher just referred to as not a school system, but a system of schools?
Yeah, I think it was. Certainly a lot of people in New Orleans consider the opportunity to rebuild the school district as kind of a blessing from the natural disaster. So, so people view it as an opportunity to build a school district from the ground up, from scratch, the right way. And that's the school district where schools are autonomous, where schools are independent, where schools have the ability to hire leaders based on their qualifications, recruit teachers based on their skills and qualifications, promote people based on performance. It's certainly one of the reasons that I came to New Orleans was the opportunity to, in effect, participate in the building of a district, a system of schools from scratch, and to really do all the right things.
So how much freedom does a guy like Sean Gallagher, who's executive director of the Akili Academy, have to hire and fire teachers, to establish curriculum, to set up his own rules? What role do you play in supervising that process?
Well, he has complete freedom. The only mandates that he's really subjected to are the mandates that the schools be open enrollment, that the application process be transparent, that there be no selectivity, that kids not be dropped from schools for reasons other than a choice, for example. In other words, that kids not be dumped. Also there are certain special education requirements, special education mandates that all the schools have to adhere to, whether they're charter schools or non-charter schools. But beyond that, there's absolutely complete freedom. But let me point out that the half of the schools that are not charter schools will also, over the next 2 to 3 years, be converting to charter school status, because In New Orleans, there are no collective bargaining agreements. There are no contracts. So principals are selected based on merit. Teachers are higher. You have slight selection of teachers. You have slight selection of staff. Next year, we're going to be moving towards a local school-based budgeting model, which is, of course, the model that individual charter schools use. You do have flexibility and freedom on the school day and on the school year. So, so I anticipate within the next 2 to 3 years, all of the schools under the control of the recovery school district, and I use that word control very narrowly, because for charter schools, control is really accountability. It's not controlling the schools as traditionally defined, which is micromanaging the schools, telling them what to do. But the schools under the jurisdiction, under the accountability jurisdiction of the RSD, Recovery School District, and incidentally, the Recovery School District is a statewide authority. It's just not, this doesn't only apply to to New Orleans. All those schools will be charters. All of the RSD schools will be charters or charter-like schools. That's where we're going to end up. We're going to end up with a system of independent charter or charter-like schools serving the children of New Orleans.
How do you determine through accountability that the schools are, in fact, going to teach the things that kids need to thrive in the American economy? If you say they have complete freedom, I don't have any examples in mind, but could somebody come in with some sort of theory of education that hadn't really been tested anyplace else, it was a sort of personal invention of theirs, and simply impose it and say, I've got a charter school, that's what I'm going to do?
Well, as long as the curriculum and instructional models are covering the state mandates, the state standards, in other words, all when charters are selected, when they submit their proposals, they submit their proposals in a very comprehensive way, including their curriculum instructional approach, how they're going to staff, size, et cetera. And all of the schools obviously need to be covering, because they're public schools, they need to be covering the standards that the state requires be taught. What the state and what the RSD doesn't tell the charter schools what we don't micromanage is the curriculum instructional models that they use to, in effect, teach the children to those standards, the pedagogies that they use, et cetera. The amount of instructional time on task that is applied and committed to so that the children can master those standards. So all those schools are required to have curriculum instructional models that meet the state standards. It's just that as long as those standards are being met, we're not going to tell them what reading curriculum to use or what math series to use or what intervention curriculums to use. You understand?
Paul Vallis, again, superintendent of the Recovery School District in New Orleans. Sean Gallagher, back to you, the executive director of the Akili Academy. You used to be a union teacher in Philadelphia. What about the fact that there are no contracts, no collective bargaining agreements? Are the teachers going for that?
It's an interesting thing, and I tell people that when I first started, when the charter movement began, I was a very young teacher in the union in Philadelphia, and I actually was anti-charter when I started because that was what I was hearing from my colleagues. Had the opportunity to become part of the startup of the Mastery Charter Schools in Philadelphia and really just recognized the freedom to do more for my students. And I think what happens is in really excellent charter schools, teachers recognize that freedom. They recognize an additional level of support. And the reasons why they might want to be in a unionized system with support from a collective bargaining agreement are gone. And they're just happy to be in a place where they have the freedom and are charged with doing the best they can for kids.
Jay Matthews, back to you, Washington Post education columnist and a reporter. What about the applications for what's going on in New Orleans? Is this, as Superintendent Vallis suggests, a place that people are looking at as a possible paradigm for other districts and other cities, or particularly because it's recovering from Katrina, is this a situation which is anomalous and unique to New Orleans?
I think it's one of the big make or break stories in American education. They're looking at New Orleans with laser-like intensity. There are a lot of reactionaries in the country who look at charter schools as just a bad idea, one more social experiment that's draining resources away from regular public schools, they don't realize that people like Sean, the very best educators we have, go into charter schools and are able to do what they know they need to be done to raise the level of kids, more time, more focused instruction, making sure they get the best teachers, and if their teachers aren't pulling their load, getting them out of the classroom. That clearly works. We've seen it in dozens of inner-city communities now. That works. The problem is that, like all charter systems, there are a lot of bad charters. And if New Orleans can fix, under Mr. Vallis and the other charter leaders, they can fix the situation where the bad charters are gotten rid of or gone, and as Sean says, if he doesn't come up to the standard, he's closed in 3 years, that kind of a system is good. If that works the way that I think that it's likely to work, then that will really put the charter school movement on a new level, and many more cities will be looking at this as a way to fix their public schools.
Jeffrey Hennig is professor of political science and education at Columbia University's Teachers College. He's also author of Spin Cycle, How Research is Used in Policy Debates, The Case of Charter Schools. Professor Hennig, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here.
What do the data show, and in what way are they being used in public debates?
Well, early on in the debate in particular, the data was very conflictual and presented in very harsh and polarized terms. But over time, as the charter school movements matured somewhat, as the research has matured and the data's gotten better, it's begun to converge on some findings that don't fit neatly with either what the most zealous advocates projected at the beginning or what some of the critics feared.
And when you say the debate was polarized, you're talking about what we just heard, that people are referring to this as just one more experiment, and others are saying that this is the panacea for education reform.
That's right. And some of the early research, stood out at each of those polls, with some researchers claiming dramatic improvements that, if replicated year after year, would very quickly close the educational gap, and others who were critical, suggesting that charter schools were basically creaming off the best students and that any higher test scores were just attributable to that fact. Over time, I think what we're beginning to see is, perhaps not surprisingly, but it's important, which is that the research is showing there are some very good charter schools and some very bad charter schools, just as there are some very good traditional public schools and some very bad ones.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation after we take a brief break. Again, Jeffrey Hennig is at the Columbia University's Teachers College. Paul Vallis, superintendent of the Recovery School District in New Orleans. Sean Gallagher, director of the Keeley Academy in that city. And Jay Matthews with the Washington Post. We'll also be talking with Valerie Lewis, who has is principal of a public school in New York, which has been very successful, not a charter school. On our reporter's notebook, we'll hear about a constructive diplomacy between the U.S. and North Korea. Back in a moment with To the Point on PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point. Once again, the Conference of National Alliance for Public School Charters is meeting in New Orleans, seen as a place where the charter school movement will be made or broken by many people, because 53% of the kids that go to public schools in that city go to charter schools. And we just heard that the other kids in public schools there may also be going to charters very, very soon. The research, according to Jeffrey Hennig at Columbia University, shows that after a great deal of great many extreme claims on both ends, there are some good ones and some bad ones. Professor Hennig, back to you. Does that suggest then that this is just one more experiment in school reform? But you can't really say that it is definitively better than what we've already got.
Well, I think that is true. We can't say right now that it's definitively better than what we've got. But to say just one more experiment, I think, is misleading in at least one sense. I entered as somewhat of a skeptic towards charter schools, and when they were initially introduced, many people saw them as really a stalking horse for vouchers, and were concerned about the threat that they would be part of a movement to privatize public education. I think charter schools, if nothing else, introduced a lot of dynamic energy, brought some people into the education area who are smart and entrepreneurial and aggressive. And exactly how this will play out over time, whether the good charter schools will muscle aside the bad ones or not, these are questions that we don't know the answers to yet, but it's important to keep watching.
What about the role of the unions, and how have they evolved in their position with regard to charter schools?
Well, your guest Sean Gallagher said earlier that initially as a union teacher he was resistant, and the unions initially were very, in almost a knee-jerk sense, resistant to charters. As I said, they were regarded suspiciously because some of the charter school proponents early on were in fact rather conservative proponents of a free market, unregulated kind of environment of education that the teachers' union saw as very threatening. I think the way charter school movements developed over time, it's clear that the notion that charter schools are public schools was not just a rhetorical flourish, that they are in many ways part of the democratic collective enterprise of education, and they're introducing potentially new ways to deliver public education rather than rivaling or threatening public education. And the teachers' unions over time, particularly the AFT, has come to see that that it needs to accommodate to the charter school movement. And in fact, some of the teachers' unions, some of the local unions are themselves now running charter schools in order to show that you can have charter schools that are not only teacher-friendly but union-friendly.
Jeffrey Henning, again, political science and education professor at Teachers College and Columbia University. Mallory Lewis is principal at PSMS 124 in Queens, New York. That's a Title I school. That means that it has a certain percentage of kids who get federal help for school lunches. About 1,250 students in grades K through 8, the same grades as Sean Gallagher has in New Orleans. Valerie Lewis, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good afternoon.
What's your view of charters? Do you find them or do you feel that they are competitive with schools such as your own?
I don't find them competitive. I find that they fill a need. In New York City, we currently have 60 charters. My concern is, as a public educator committed to public education, we're not doing enough for our public schools.
Well, are the charters, though, public schools?
The charters are, but you're pulling off a certain amount of children, not enough to make a difference. We have 1.3 million students in New York with only 60 charters that serve 12,000 children. What are we doing for all those other students in failing schools?
Are you suggesting that there's a cherry-picking of students going on, that the good ones go to the charters and the others don't?
In some, not all. In some, there's a lottery. It depends. But there are some that are taking the top children. I would like to see charter schools that open up that take the most at-risk children. That would ease up the room for the public schools to move the majority of the children.
I should ask about the student achievement at your own school, where you have a lot of at-risk children. How are you doing?
Very well. Very well. We're in the 80th and 90th percentile, but that's been a nine-year endeavor because we are a core knowledge school. So when I heard someone say earlier about partnerships in education and being able to move instruction, sometimes the charter schools are committed for 2 or 3 or 5 years, and if they don't meet their mandates, they're gone. I think that public or charter schools have to have a long range of instructional programs that energizes the staff to move students, and that's what we've been able to do over the last 9 years. We started in the 30th percentile.
How have you done that without the kinds of things that we heard about that are virtues of charter schools? The fact that there's no school board, there's no teachers union. You can hire and fire whenever you want to, presumably for a cause under state law. But all of that liberation that we heard about earlier, how did you do that without that?
Daring to be different, working within the parameters of what you could do, and then crossing the line and showing them what needed to be done. And I must say that the union has supported it. The chancellor has supported it. He's done the empowerment initiative now, where we all have free rein on our budgets, on who we hire and fire. So that has added to the support of what we needed to do. but it's having a focus and staying true to it. I mean, I have a staff of 125, and they don't leave. That's another thing. It's that continuity and giving the teachers the professional development and giving the community that saw a school that was failing 9 years ago and in the 30th percentile, that when you sustain something over time, that you will develop well-rounded children.
But you have free range to hire and fire, so you can remove teachers that you don't feel are performing well, even though there's a union and union regulations to deal with?
Yes, much more than ever before.
Now, is that true citywide or only in your school?
No, citywide they have given us much more flexibility than ever before.
Valerie Lewis, the principal, again, at PSMS 124 in Queens. Let me go back to Paul Vallis, the superintendent of the Recovery School District in New Orleans. So what are you doing that's so different from what we just heard that Valerie Lewis is able to do in New York in a school that's not a charter school?
Well, actually, nothing, because all of our non-charter schools have the same institutional flexibility, or I should say lack of institutional obstacles, just as charters. For example, selection of principals based on the most qualified individual, the hiring of teachers based on ability, and the promotion of individuals based on performance, the longer school day, the longer school year, the mandated additional professional development, the implementation of a TAP program for, in effect, selecting leadership teams at the local school who can work with, mentor, and manage, and evaluate, and support the teachers. So all the public schools, all the traditional public schools, have really charter-like authority, charter-like autonomy. And, the only thing that's missing is the local individual governing board. And of course, some of the principals haven't learned how to take full advantage of their autonomy. I also want to make another point, too. In Philadelphia, one-third of our schools in Philadelphia were either managed by charters or private managers. And one-third of the kids attended either charter or privately managed schools. For the last 6 years, Philadelphia has showed strong growth in test scores. In fact, last year, 13 out of 14 categories. This year, the test score is about to be announced. Every single category, every single grade level. And the amazing thing is that the charter schools are performing as well. They're within 1 or 2 percentage points of the traditional public schools. The growth has been virtually identical, and only a few percentage points separates the schools. The reason for that is twofold. One is the public schools have received more autonomy. They have been able to, increase the length of the school day, dramatically expand summer school. They introduced site selection of teachers. They began to promote people based on merit. A lot of the institutional obstacles that are a lot of times embedded in collective bargaining agreements, like in New York, were relaxed so that traditional public schools would have the same flexibility as charter schools. The second thing, most important factor, is accountability. Charter schools and public schools in Philadelphia, just as charter schools and traditional public schools in New Orleans, are being held and are going to be held to the same strong accountability standards. It's accountability for everyone. And so when you have that, when you break down the barriers, because what charter schools are, you call them freedom schools, freedom from seniority, freedom from tenure, freedom from having your staff picked for you, having seniority determine who gets promoted, freedom from restricting the amount of professional development time you should have, or freedom from having limitations on your school year and your school day. You see what I mean? Once you give all schools that flexibility and that freedom, and once you impose a tough accountability system that it treats everyone equally, everyone the same, you will have a thriving, dynamic school system.
Paul Vallis, again, Superintendent, Recovery School District in New Orleans. Jay Matthews, back to you with the Washington Post. Does this suggest that in New York and in Philadelphia, that as a result of having charter schools, the public schools, the traditional public schools, have changed for the better?
I think it's absolutely right. What we're seeing is a sort of a cultural revolution. You have on your staff a producer, Dan Konecki, who was part of the Teach for America program. We're recruiting our brightest young people out of college to teach in the inner city. Those Teach for America people, I call it the Teach for America's insurgency, have flowed into schools like the ones we're describing in New Orleans and New York and the charter schools, and have made a cultural change. Miss Lewis's school is as good as it is because she's over 9 years managed to change the culture, so the focus is on achievement, the focus is on kids' problems, not adults' problems. That's what the Teach for America insurgency does. Those young people, now in their 30s, early 40s, are spreading throughout the country with that focus. They're in New Orleans, they're in New York, they're in Philadelphia, and that's the real change. Those young people who are really focused in a way that our educators have never been before, it's really sort of the Peace Corps of this era, changing things in our schools, and that's the real grounds for hope. And schools like Miss Lewis's and the charter schools give those bright young people who have that focus on achievement, focus on really this is a calling, a mission for them, gives them the freedom to do what they know has to be done, and that's a big improvement.
Sean Gallagher, a former anti-charter school teacher in Philadelphia, now running a charter school in New Orleans, where he moved in order to have that opportunity. 2 points made by Valerie Lewis. So one is that the charters in New York, to some extent, she said, are cherry-picking the best students. The other that they have contracts that can expire after 2 to 5 years. What happens to the kids in the schools that fail?
Honestly, I don't know, and I hope I never find that out. That's not in the plan for us. I would imagine they...
But it's a risk, is it not?
It certainly is, and that's a risk that we embrace. I mean, if we're not held to those high standards, I mean, I think one of the things that hurts education is the lack of a high bar across how the accountability that teachers and administrators are held to, and also kids. So I like the high bar. It gives us excellence to strive for. In New Orleans, with so much choice, if a school closes, and some schools have closed this year, parents then have a smorgasbord of other schools to choose from.
But what about the cherry-picking issue and the notion that the best kids get the best education when there's a charter school available?
There are some charter schools that are doing that, and I'm fiercely against it, and I think I would hope that anyone who's in the charter movement or in public education, for that matter, would be fiercely against it. I believe that we are an open enrollment school, and I wouldn't want to open this school any other way. And if I were in Valerie's shoes and there were schools that were cherry-picking, I would have a problem with that, absolutely.
Valerie Lewis, do you buy the contention that because of charter schools, traditional public schools have been made better?
Yes. I think that it's given parents options, especially the schools that have an overabundance of children that are not achieving, that the children going to charter schools are taking off a certain amount of weight on a school so that they can move forward with the other children on the left. The problem is that there are not enough children going into charter schools being given that option from failing schools.
So would the paradigm, if that's the right term, that we're seeing in New Orleans, where, according to Paul Vallis, pretty soon all the public school kids are going to be in charters, would that work in New York and other cities?
I think it has to be a collaboration of public and charters working together so that if either doesn't work, then the other one can pick up the slack. You see, we don't have time to waste the children. Since NCLB, there are too many children. We have over 350,000 children in New York City that are falling through the gaps because they can't get into these charter schools. The charter schools are opening, some of them with 200 to 300 students. We have schools with 12 and 13 and 1,500 students. So we have to find a balance to give everybody the opportunity to be successful and for children to learn.
Jeffrey Henning, again, at Columbia University, how is this administered in terms of finance, and how does a school system that has both charter and non-charter schools in it decide who gets the money, particularly when some are bigger than others and that there are all these differences in curriculum and that the way the charters treat teachers and so on and so forth? Does that become a sort of administrative nightmare?
Well, one thing that is important to bear in mind is that charter school laws are state laws. It's not a national program, and what the rules that, you know, determine what a charter school is and what a charter school gets in terms of funding vary state to state. So the first answer is it depends. It also is important to bear in mind for your listeners that in many cases the chartering authority is not the local district as it is in New York for most of the charter schools, or in New Orleans under the Recovery School District, but there are sometimes separate chartering authorities, and in some states multiple chartering authorities, including universities, that can charter schools. So the story is complicated from place to place. I do want to make one general point and then specifically very quickly answer your question. General point is that I do think what we're seeing is a convergence to some extent between charter school community and the traditional public school community in some well-run districts. That is to say, the charter schools are becoming more public-like, more publicly accountable than many of the early Wild West entrepreneurial visions held, and the public schools are becoming more decentralized and entrepreneurial than the traditional rigorous hierarchical bureaucracies.
I'm going to have to interrupt you, and I apologize for that, but we're simply out of time. Thanks to all of you very much for being with us. At Jeffrey Hennig at Columbia University, Paul Vallis, the superintendent of the Recovery School District in New Orleans, Valerie Lewis at PSMS 124 in Queens, Sean Gallagher of the Akili Academy in New Orleans, and Jay Matthews with the Washington Post, education columnist and reporter. We'll come back, talk about this in the future. North Korea was part of President Bush's axis of evil, but it's about to be removed from the U.S. list of countries that sponsor terrorism. That's in exchange for turning over a long-awaited inventory of its nuclear program to China. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In the White House Rose Garden today, President Bush described the latest diplomatic agreement with North Korea.
If North Korea continues to make the right choices, it can repair its relationship with the international community, much as Libya has done over the past few years. If North Korea makes the wrong choices, the United States and our partners in the six-party talks will respond accordingly.
Selig Harrison is director of the Asia Program and chairman of the Task Force on U.S.-Korean Policy at the Center for International Policy in Washington. Always good to have you on our program.
Okay.
How important is this?
I think it's very important because from North Korea, it's a real breakthrough in moving toward a phased process in which North Korea denuclearizes and the U.S. normalizes its relations with North Korea. And this, the declaration that North Korea has now turned over to the six-party talks and its chairman, China, is a very important milestone because it lays out for all these six countries to know how much North Korea, how much nuclear material North Korea has. This will be subject to a verification process that's yet to be agreed upon, but the fact that they're laying out how much nuclear material they have, what nuclear facilities they have, and that this is all going to be confirmed is a very important milestone. There's still some important steps to go before we get the complete denuclearization of North Korea, but what we've got this time is a shutting down of the plutonium production that they have been carrying on, which has created, of course, not only the danger of nuclear test again and the development of more nuclear weapons, but also the export of the plutonium to third parties, terrorists, and others. So this is a major step forward in denuclearizing North Korea.
Now, what it doesn't do, though, is reveal how many completed nuclear weapons North Korea has or say much of anything about the uranium enrichment program. That's another question as well.
That's right. Now, from the beginning, this has been a phased agreement, synchronized steps in parallel by the two sides, both of which don't trust the other. And so there are things the U.S. hasn't done yet to normalize relations, which will also come in a later stage. And as we move down the road to complete normalization with North Korea, they will move down the road to telling us how many nuclear devices they have. And the final stage, of course, will be getting them to ship out of the country their nuclear material and their nuclear devices. But that's going to come at the very end of the process.
One of the things they are supposed to do at some point in this process is blow up the cooling tower of the main nuclear reactor. That's supposed to be broadcast live on television by crews from the U.S., South Korea, China, Japan, and Russia. Do you really expect that to happen?
Oh, yes. I think it's going to happen. They're prepared to liquidate this plutonium program. They won't give up their actual bombs, their nuclear devices, and they won't let the fissile material they haven't yet put into devices, they won't let that out of the country until we've actually executed some of the things we have promised to do. Now, the big concession the U.S. has made, it's very important, is North Korea will be removed from the list of terrorist states that the State Department maintains. And that, as when you're on that list, you can't get into line to join the World Bank, you can't get into the Asian Development Bank. Multilateral aid is denied from North Korea to North Korea. So getting that terrorist list, North Korea removed, getting that finalized is very important. And there's a 45-day period ahead now. It's sort of a waiting period in which Congress has to be given 45 days notice. Now, during that period, the U.S. experts are going to be examining this declaration in detail. In broad outlines, it's been negotiated behind the scenes already. It's kind of a pre-cooked declaration of what they have. But there's going to be some fine-tooth comb examination of this. Already, North Korea, you know, had given us 19,000 pages of records, 7 boxes of their nuclear history, which was brought over to Washington, and they've been going through it at the State Department. Now they have 45 days more to go through the rest of that stuff and to go through the declaration. And so there's still, there's many a slip, tricks the cup and the lip, and Congress, there will be opponents of their removal from the terrorist list, but it looks to me like this is a done deal now and that it's a very important one indeed.
You mentioned earlier that there's no trust between the two countries, and particularly with the Bush administration, there has been no trust. And some of the people, former U.S. Ambassador, U.N. Ambassador Bolton, for example, don't like these kinds of deals at all. Are there provisions in here that could cause them to doubt that the North Koreans would make good, that they would violate their promises, or have the North Koreans moved forward to a point where it would appear maybe there's no going back?
Well, I think they'll have trouble making the case that the plutonium program could be revived because they're blowing up the cooling tower there. This is very definitive action on the plutonium program. What the Bolton camp says is that North Korea has a secret uranium enrichment program, which could give them an alternative route other than plutonium, to nuclear weapons. Now, that was the position of the Bush administration in 2002, on the basis of which they abrogated the existing agreement we had with North Korea, under which they had frozen their plutonium production during the Clinton period. And it was that abrogation, in the name of North Korea's having cheated, allegedly, that led to the crisis in which North Korea accumulated plutonium again and was able to conduct a nuclear test. Now, Bolton and his point of view is that the uranium issue hasn't been settled. There's something to this. We don't know whether North Korea, some of its imports of equipment that could be used for uranium enrichment were used for anything more than an experimental R&D program, which is what seems most likely, or whether, as Bolton would argue, they have a secret weapons-grade capability. We don't have any evidence of that that's been put forward. And I feel it was exaggerated evidence on the whole uranium side to justify ending the Clinton-era agreement, the agreed framework, the nuclear freeze, which we had with North Korea. But the big key to this is that Pakistan, the source of most of the evidence that Bolton would rely upon is statements by Musharraf in Pakistan that Pakistan gave North Korea, he said, nearly 24 centrifuges to enrich uranium. This is in Musharraf's memoirs, but there's been no evidence put forward to back that up, nor has there been any evidence given to the United States by Pakistan, which the U.S. can use in negotiations with North Korea to say, look, Pakistan says they gave you these centrifuges. Where are they? So Pakistan hasn't cooperated, and Mr. A.Q. Khan, the Dr. Strangelove of Pakistan, has been unavailable to U.S. Interrogators to the IAEA, and the uranium issue could never really be solved until we get Pakistan to give us evidence that they did transfer nuclear uranium technology to North Korea, or to acknowledge that they really don't have the evidence, and maybe Musharraf was saying this to make the Bush administration happy because it wanted to point the finger at North Korea.
All right. Obviously, a lot, as you said, between the cup and the lip here, and we will be following it. And in the meantime, thank you very much for leaving us better informed.
Thank you.
Tillich Harrison, Director of the Asia Program and Chair of the Task Force on U.S.-Korean Policy at the Center for International Policy in Washington. Today's program produced by Dan Konecki, Christian Bordahl, and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To the Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.